This is the story of,
how the potato-faced blind man came down to his work sitting at the corner nearest the post office in the village of Liver and Onions, playing his gold and used to be accordion to the pleasure of the years of the people going into the post office to see if they got any letters from themselves. Or for their families.
It is a good day, a lucky day.
It is a good day, a lucky day, said the potato faced blind man.
Because for a beginning I have heard high in the elm trees the funny whisters yodeling their yesters in the long branches the lingering leaves.
So
I am going to listen to myself playing my accordion, the same yesters, the same yodels, drawing them like long glad breathings out of glad accordion, long breathing the branches of the lingering leaves. He sat down. On the sleeve of his coat.
On the sleeve of his coat. He tied his
mind. I am blind, too.
I am blind.
Top button of his coat, he hung a little thimble.
His coat, he hung a little thimble.
On the bottom button of his coat,
bottom
he hung
button.
A thin copper cup.
Copper cup.
On the middle button, he hung
on the
a
middle button.
Mug. By the side of him on the left side.
By the side of him on the left side,
and
galvanized iron wash tub. And on the right side, an aluminum dishpan.
It is a good day, a lucky day, and
day.
I am
sure many people will stop and remember the potato-faced blind man. He sang to himself like a song as he began
running
down the keys of the accordion.
Yesters
of the lingering leaves and the elm trees. Then came pickups.
Always it happened.
Pickups asked.
So this is how, questions
so this is how the
questions
and answers ran when the potato face filled the ears.
What is the piece you're playing
what is hang on the keys of your accordion
so sad some of the
sometimes
moments,
so sad some of the moments, so glad some of the moments?
It is the
song the mama
flies.
Button loose the winter underwear.
And sing, fly,
and sing, fly you little flummy.
Little whisters.
Whisters?
Why do you have a little symbol
on the top button of your coat?
The diamonds to
put in. Some people say, put in a whole thimble full of tin copper cup. Players to stand off ten nickels and pennies.
The
one who throws them. And the wooden mug. The bottom
hole is as big as the bottom.
The nickel goes in. It is for the very poor people who wish to give me a nickel, get the nickel back. The aluminum dishpan and the galvanized iron wash tub, what are they doing by the side of you on both sides on the sidewalk? Sometimes, maybe it will happen someday, somebody who goes out will stop and pour out
afraid
their money's no good anymore. If such ever happens, then it will be nice for the people to have some place to pour their money, such as why you see the aluminum dishpan and tub. Explain. Why is it? I am blind, too. Oh, I'm sorry to explain to you, pickups, why this is so which. Some of the people who pass by to the post office and coming out, they have eyes, but they see nothing with their eyes. They look where they're going, they get where they wish to get, but they forget why they came, and they do not know how to come away. They are my blind brothers. It's for them I have the sign that reads, I am blind too. And my ears full of explanations, and I thank you, said pickups. Goodbye, said the potato-faced blind man, as he began drawing long breathings like lingering leaves out of the accordion, along with the song the mama flummy whisters sing when they button loose the winter underwear. Baby flummy whisters. Bears are very clever all over the world. It is said of them that they have the strength of 10 men and the sense of 12. Perhaps the terrible cold and the scarcity of food sharpen their wits, and at any rate, whatever the cause, the polar bear is one of the very wisest of his race. He is so expert in hunting that the Eskimos have learned from him, lying on the side and stealing up to a sleepy seal and amusing it when awake with a monotonous noise called seal talk was done by bears before men learned the trick. The polar bear also likes the baby seal, especially the mother bear when she comes out of her winter's home with her cubs. At that time she hunts with special care for a seal nursery, that she may jump on the roof and break it in, as I told you the Eskimos do. The little seal she gives her babies to eat, after she's caught the mother by help of it, in the way that men do, that is, holding it in the passage to the water till its mother comes to take care of it, and then seizing her with the other paw. Nanook's baby also has a nursery under the snow. In the fall, the mother bear eats a big dinner of meat and then goes to her den for the winter. Sometimes this retreat is a small cave under the rocks, sometimes under the roots of a tree, and sometimes nothing but a cave dug in a snowbank. Whichever it may be, it is a comfortable place, for more snow falls and covers up the door, leaving the sleepy bear warm and safe from all enemies, and she needs no more food till spring. In this home, the babies are born, and as soon as spring opens and they're big enough to go with her, she leads them out to hunt a fat seal or something else nice to eat. At this time, Mother Nanook is savage, and it is particularly dangerous to meet her, though I heard an amusing story of one bear who ran away from the hunters. She had two cubs, and they could not run fast enough, so this wise parent pushed them along with her nose. They were knowing little fellows, too, and when she pushed one far ahead, he would run along and put himself before her again for another push. So they went on, and you'll be glad to know that the brave mother saved both her babies and herself from the hunters. This is a portion of The Biography of a Grizzly by Ernest Seton Thompson. The years went on as before, except that each winter Wahb slept less soundly, and each spring he came out earlier and was a bigger grizzly, with fewer enemies than that dared to face him. When his sixth year came, he was a very big, strong, sullen bear, with neither friendship nor love in his life since that evil day on the lower Piney. No one ever heard of Wahb's mate. No one believes that he ever had one. The love season of bears came and went year after year, but left him alone in his prime as he had been in his youth. It is not good for a bear to be alone. It is bad for him in every way. His habitual moroseness grew with his strength, and anyone chancing to meet him now would have called him a dangerous grizzly. He had lived in the Meteetse Valley since first he betook himself there, and his character had been shaped by many little adventures with traps and his wild rivals of the mountains. But there was none of the latter that he now feared, and he knew enough to avoid the first, for that penetrating odor of man and iron was a never-failing warning, especially after an experience which befell him in his sixth year. His ever-reliable nose told him that there was a dead elk down among the timber. He went up the wind, and there, sure enough, was the great delicious carcass, already torn open at the very best place. True, there was that terrible man and iron taint, but it was so slight and the feast so tempting that after circling around and inspecting the carcass from his 8 feet of stature as he stood erect, he went cautiously forward and at once was caught by his left paw in an enormous bear trap. He roared with pain and slashed about in a fury, but this was no beaver trap. It was a big 40-pound bear catcher, and he was surely caught. Wahb fairly foamed with rage and madly grit his teeth upon the trap. Then he remembered his former experiences. He placed the trap between his hind legs, with a hind paw on each spring, and pressed down with all his weight. But it was not enough. He dragged off the trap and its clog and went clanking up the mountain. Again and again he tried to free his foot, but in vain, till he came where a great trunk crossed the trail a few feet from the ground. By chance or happy thought, he reared again under this and made a new attempt. With a hind foot on each spring and his mighty shoulders underneath the tree, he bore down with his titanic strength. The great steel springs gave way, the jaws relaxed, and he tore out his foot. So Wahb was free again, though he left behind a great toe, which had been nearly severed by the first snap of the steel. Again Wahb had a painful wound to nurse, and as he was a left-handed bear, that is, when he wished to turn a rock over, he stood on the right paw and turned with the left. One result of this disablement was to rob him for a time of all those dainty foods that are found under rocks or logs. The wound healed at last, but he never forgot that experience, and thenceforth the pungent smell of man and iron, even without the gun smell, never failed to enrage him. Many experiences had taught him that it is better to run if he only smelled the hunter or heard him far away, but to fight desperately if the man was close at hand. And the cowboy soon came to know that the upper Meteetse was the range of a bear that was better let alone. One day, after a long absence, Wahb came into the lower part of his range and saw to his surprise one of the wooden dens that men make for themselves. As he came around to get the wind, he sensed the taint that never failed to infuriate him now, and a moment later he heard a loud bang and felt a stinging shock in his left hind leg, the old stiff leg. He wheeled about in time to see a man running toward the new-made shanty. Had the shot been in his shoulder, Wahb would have been helpless, but it was not. Mighty arms that could toss pine logs like broomsticks, paws that with one tap could crush the biggest bull upon the range, claws that could tear huge slabs of rock from the mountainside. What was even the deadly rifle to them? When the man's partner came home that night, he found him on the Reddin's shanty floor. The bloody trail from the outside and a shaky scribbled note in the back of a paper novel told the tale. It said this. It was Wob done it. I seen him by the spring and wounded him. I tried to get to the shanty, but he catched me. My God, how I suffer. Jack. It was all fair. The man had invaded the bear's country, had tried to take the bear's life, and had lost his own. But Jack's partner swore he would kill that bear. He took up the trail and followed it up the canyon, and there bushwhacked and hunted day after day. He put out baits and traps, and at length one day he heard a crash, clatter, thump, and a huge rock bounded down a bank into a wood, scaring out a couple of deer that floated away like thistledown. Miller thought at first that it was a landslide, but he soon knew that it was Wob that had rolled the boulder over merely for the sake of two or three ants beneath it. The wind had not betrayed him, so on peering through the bush, Miller saw the great bear as he fed, favoring his left hind leg and growling sullenly to himself at a fresh twinge of pain. Miller steadied himself and thought, here goes a finisher or a dead miss. He gave a sharp whistle. The bear stopped every move, and as he stood with ears acock, the man fired at his head. But at that moment the great shaggy head moved. Only infuriating scratch was given. The smoke betrayed the man's place, and the grizzly made savage three-legged haste to catch his foe. Miller dropped his gun and swung lightly into a tree, the only large one near. Wob raged in vain against the trunk. He tore off the bark with his teeth and claws, but Miller was safe beyond his reach. For fully 4 hours the grizzly watched, then gave it up, and slowly went off into the bushes till lost to view. Miller watched him from the tree, and afterward waited nearly an hour to be sure that the bear was gone. He then slipped to the ground, got his gun, and set out for camp. But Wob was cunning. He had only seemed to go away, and then had sneaked back quietly to watch. As soon as the man was away from the tree, too far to return, Wob dashed after him. In spite of his wounds, the bear could move the faster. Within a quarter of a mile, well, Wob did just what the man had sworn to do to him. Long afterward, his friends found the gun and enough to tell the tale. The claim shanty on the Meteetse fell to pieces. It never again was used, for no man cared to enter a country that had but few allurements to offset its evident curse of ill luck, and where such a terrible grizzly was always on the warpath. This is a portion of a story by Charles G.D. Roberts called The Return to the Trails, and it's about a bear that escapes from a circus and finds itself back where it grew up as a cub. Now began, for the returned exile, 2 or 3 months of just such a life as he had longed for. The keen and tonic winds that blew around the peak of Sugarloaf filled his veins with vigor. Through his lack of education in the lore of the wilderness, his diet was less varied than it might have been, but this was the fat of the year, and he fared well enough. When the late berries and fruits were all gone, there were sweet tubers and starchy roots to be grubbed up along the meadow levels by the water. Instinct and a spirit of investigation soon taught him to find the beetles and grubs that lurked under stones or in rotting logs, and in the course of such a search he one day discovered that ants were good to eat. But the small animals with which a wild bear is prone to vary his diet were all absent from his bill of fare. Rabbits, woodchucks, chipmunks, wood mice, they all kept out of his sight. His ignorance of the law of silence, the universal law of the wild, deprived him of many toothsome morsels. As for the many kinds of fungus which grew upon the mountain, he knew not which were edible and which poisonous. After an experiment with one pleasant-smelling red-skinned specimen, which gave him excruciating cramps, he left the whole race of fungi severely alone. For perhaps a month he had the solitudes to himself, except for the big, scornful-looking eagle which always spent a portion of every day sitting on the top of a blasted pine about 100 feet above the den. But at length, one crisp morning when he was down by the lakeside fishing, he found a mate. A young she-bear came out of the bushes, looked at him, then turned as if to run away, but didn't. The exile stopped fishing and waited civilly to see if the newcomer wanted to fight. Evidently, she had no such desire. The exile took a few steps up the beach.
which action seemed to terrify the newcomer almost into flight. Seeing this, he sat down on his haunches amiably and waited to see what she would do. What she did, after much hesitation and delay and half-retreat, was to come up to his side and sniff trustfully but wonderingly at the great iron-studded leather collar on his neck. After that, the two soon reached an understanding, and for the next 6 weeks or so they spent most of their time together. Under his mate's instruction, or else by force of her example, the big bear made some progress in woodcraft and gained some inklings of the lesson of silence. He learned also to distinguish between the wholesome and the poisonous fungi. He learned the sweets of a bee tree, and how a bear must go to work to attain them. Moving through the shadows more quietly, he now had glimpses of rabbits and chipmunks, and even caught sight of a wood mouse whisking into his hole under a root. But before he had acquired the cunning to capture any of these shy kindreds, his mate wandered away on her own affairs intent, and he found himself once more alone. Frosts by this time were binding swale and pool. Ice was forming far out from the edges of the lake. The first snows had fallen, and the great snows were threatening, and the little she-bear was getting ready to creep into a hole and curl up for her winter's sleep. She no longer wanted company, not even the company of this splendid black comrade whose collar had so filled her with admiration. When, at length, the winter of the north had fairly settled down upon the Squatooks, the exile's ribs were well encased in fat. But that fortunate condition was not to last long. When the giant winds, laden with snow and arctic cold, thundered and shrieked about the peak of Sugarloaf, and in the loud darkness strange shapes of drift rode down the blast, he slept snugly enough in the narrow depths of his den. But the essential winter lore of his kind he had not learned. He had not learned to sleep away the time of storm and famine. As for instinct, it failed him altogether in this emergency. During his 5 years of life with the circus, he had had no chance to gratify his winter drowsiness, and gradually the power to hibernate had passed away from him. The loss was irremediable. By this one deprivation, his contact with man had ruined him for the life of nature. When man has snatched away from nature one of her wild children, nature, merciless in her resentments, is apt to say, "Keep him. He is none of mine." And if the alien, his heart aching for his own, insists upon returning, nature turns a face of stone against him. Unskilled in hunting as he was, and unable to sleep, the bear was soon driven to extremes. At rare intervals he succeeded in capturing a rabbit. Once or twice, after a fierce frost had followed a wet sleet storm, he had climbed trees and found dead birds frozen to their perches. But most of the time he had had nothing but starvation rations of wood ants and buds. In the course of a few weeks he was as lean as a heron, and his collar hung loose in his fur. He was growing to hate the icy and glittering desolation, and, as he had once longed for an untried freedom, now he longed for the companionship of men. He was now wandering far afield in his daily quest for food, sometimes not returning for 3 or 4 days at a time. Once, on an excursion over into the Madawaska Valley, he had come upon a deadfall trap temptingly baited with pork. He pushed forward ravenously to snatch the bait, but just in time that scent called up an ancient memory. The horror and the shock of that far-off day when such a trap had crushed his mother's life out came back upon him. It was not the scene exactly that came back, but rather the memory of an anguish. Obscure as it was, it had power to master his appetite and drive him to another foraging ground. Thenceforth, he foraged no more in the Madawaska Valley. In such a desolate fashion the exile dragged through the frozen weeks, till February came in with deeper snows and fiercer frosts. At this time hunger and loneliness drove him far over to the valley of Toledi, and here, one still and biting day, he came upon a human trail. Delightedly he sniffed at the familiar scent, which to him, as pleasant memories of food and companionship welled up in his heart, represented nothing but kindliness. His little disagreements with his trainer were forgotten. He remembered only his unfailing friends, the manager and the clown. The trail was a broad and mixed one, the trail of oxen and of men with laryngeal feet. It led toward a camp of lumbermen near the river. Joyously and confidently the exile followed it. Soon he heard men's voices and the familiar clank of chains. Then a biting breeze drew through the forest, biting but sweet to the bear's nostrils. It carried a savor of richness from the cook's steaming boilers. It was a dinner hour at the camp. For the second time in his life, the bear felt that he had come home. Captive, indeed, he had been among men, but a captive always highly valued and heedfully cared for. He never for a moment doubted that these men creatures who had always wanted him would want him now. They would chain him up, of course, for fear he would change his mind and leave them again, but they would feed him, all he could eat, and stare at him, and admire him. Then he would dance for them, and do foolish things with a gun, and perhaps stand on his head, whereupon they would applaud and laugh and feed him with peanuts and gingerbread. His famished jaws dripped at the thought. Within the camp, one of the hands, glancing from the window, saw him just as he came in view. In an instant, every man was looking out. The boldness of the animal stirred up a great excitement. His terrible leanness was noticed. He was coming straight for the door, evidently savage, insane with hunger, and such a big fellow, too. Men seized their axes. The boss snatched down his big bore Snyder rifle, slipped in a cartridge, and coolly threw open the cabin door. He was a tall, ruddy-faced, wide-mouthed man, much like the kindly manager of the show. At sight of him standing there in the door, the bear was overjoyed and broke into a shuffling run. Seeing what seemed to them such reckless ferocity, the lumberman cried out in amazement and shouted hoarse warnings to the boss, but the boss was a man of nerve. Raising his rifle to the shoulder, he stepped right out clear of the door. He was a dead shot, and very proud of the fact. When the bear was within 30 paces of him, he fired. The massive bullet sped true, and the exile fell forward on his snout, without a gasp, shot through the brain. The men gathered about the body, praising the shot, praising the prize, praising the reckless audacity which had led the beast to rush upon his doom. Then in the long, loose fur that clothed his bones, they found the heavy collar. At that they all wondered. The boss examined it minutely and stood pondering, and the frank pride upon his face gradually died into regret. "A swan, boys," said he presently, "if that ain't the bar that run away from the circus last fall." This is the bear story that little Alex is made up his own self. Why, once there was a little boy went out in the woods to shoot a bear. So he went out way in the great big woods, he did. And he was going along, you know. And pretty soon he heard something go, "Whoo, it's that away. Whoo." And he was scared, he was. And so he runned and clumbed a tree. A great big tree, he did. A sycamore tree. And then he heard it again. And he looked around, and 'twas a bear. A great big sure enough bear. No, 'twas two bears, it was. Two great big bears. One of them was. Ist one's a great big bear, but they both went, "Whoo," and here they come to climb the tree and get the little boy and eat him up. And then the little boy, he is scared worse than ever. And here come the great big bear climbing the tree to get the little boy and eat him up. Oh, no. It isn't the big bear that climbed the tree. It is a little bear. So here he come climbing the tree and climbing the tree. And then, when he get white close to the little boy, why, then the little boy, he has pulled up his gun and shot the bear, he did, and killed him dead. And then the bear, he fall clean on down out of the tree, away clean to the ground, he did, spling splung, he fall plumb down and killed him, too, and lit white side of where the big bear's at. And the big bear's awful mad, you bet, cause the little boy, he shot his gun and killed the little bear. Cause the big bear, he's the little bear's papa. And so here he come to climb the big old tree and get the little boy and eat him up. And when the little boy, he saw the great big bear coming, he's badder scared he was than any time. And so he think he'll climb up higher, way up higher in the tree than the old bear can climb, you know. But he can't climb higher than old bears can climb, because bears can climb higher up in the trees than any little boys in all the world. And so here come the great big bear, he did, a-climbing up and up the tree to get the little boy and eat him up. And so the little boy, he climbed on higher and higher and higher up the tree and higher and higher and higher in this here house is. Here come the old bear, closer to him all the time. And then,
First thing you know, when the old big bear was white close to him, and the little boy just jabbed his gun right in the old bear's mouth and shot and killed him dead. No, I forgot. He didn't shoot the great big bear at all, because there's no load in the gun, you know? Because when he shot the little bear, why, then no load is any more in the gun. But the little boy climbed higher up, he did. He climbed lots higher, and on up higher, and higher, and higher, till he just can't climb no higher, because then the limbs is all so little, way up in the teeny-weeny tip-top of the tree, they'd break down with him if he don't be careful. So he stop and think. And then he look around, and here come the old bear. And so the little boy make up his mind he's got to ist get out of there some way, because here come the old bear, so close to his breath's pert nigh so's he can feel how hot it is against his bare feet. It's like old Ring's breath when he's been out hunting's all tired. So when the old bear's so close, the little boy gives a great big jump for another tree. No. No, he don't do that. I'll tell you what the little boy does. Why, then, why he... Oh, yes, the little boy, he finds a hole up there. It's in the tree. And climbs in there. And hides. And then the old bear can't find the little boy at all. But pretty soon the old bear finds the little boy's gun that's up there. Because the gun, it's too tall to tuck with him in the hole. So when the old bear finds a gun, he knows the little boy is hid round somewheres there. And the old bear begins to snuff and sniff around, and sniff and snuff around so's he can find out where the little boy's hid at. And then, oh yeah, why, pretty soon the old bear climbs way out on a big limb, a great long limb, and then the little boy climbs out the hole and takes his axe and chops a limb off. And the old bear falls ka-splunge clean to the ground and bust and kill himself plumb dead, he did. And then the little boy, he get his gun and mends to climbing down the tree again. No, he didn't get his gun, because when the bear falled, then the gun falled too. And broke it all to pieces, too. And nicest gun his pa spied it. And little boy just cried, he did, and went on climbing down the tree, and climbing down, and climbing down. And, sir, when he's pert nigh down, why, then, the old bear, he jumped up again. And he ain't dead at all. He's tending that away, so he can get the little boy and eat him up. But the little boy, he's too smart to climb clean down the tree. And the old bear, he can't climb up the tree no more, because when he fell, he broke one of his, he broke all his legs. And then he couldn't climb. But he just won't go away and let the little boy come down out of the tree. And the old bear is growls round there, he does. His growls and goes, woo, woo, all the time. And little boy have to stay up in the tree all night. And without no supper neither. Only they was apples on the tree. And little boy ate apples, ist all night, and cried, and cried. Then when 'tis morning, the old bear went, woo, again, and tried to climb up in the tree and get the little boy. But he can't climb to save his soul, he can't. And, oh, he's mad. He just tear up the ground and go, woo, and, oh, yes, pretty soon, when morning's come all light so's you can see, you know, why, then, the old bear finds the little boy's gun, you know. It's on the ground, and it ain't broke at all. I said that. And so the old bear think he'll take the gun and shoot the little boy. But bears, they don't know much about shooting guns. So when he go to shoot the little boy, the old bear got the other end of the gun against his shoulder instead of the other end. So when he tried to shoot the little boy, it shot the bear, it did, and killed him dead. And then the little boy clumbed down the tree and chopped his old woolly head off. Yes, and killed the other bear again, he did, and killed all both the bears, he did, and took 'em home and cooked 'em too and ate 'em. And that's all.